Friday. It's Friday, it's Friday, it's Friday. Friday.
Welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Happy Friday.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
You're a lying dog-faced pony soldier.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Crank them speakers.
Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday. Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
You want to save America? I'm asking everybody to go and swampthevoteusa.com, swampthevoteusa.com, to make a plan to vote either by mail or early in person or an election day. Just vote.
Just vote. That is some good advice. Make sure you vote. Except that vote by mail this year promises a new kind of election disaster for 2024. And I'll make the case with real numbers. Let me point something out. In just the last 4 years, the number of people who vote by mail went up dramatically from 2016 to 2020. It went up by about 20%. And the system was absolutely overwhelmed by that. This year promises to be even worse. And where do we find that out? We find it out from the U.S. Postal Service, and I'll source most of this information, comes from the Inspector General of the USPS. Now, the Inspector General is a position in most federal agencies, and his or her job is to watch what that agency does, find the flaws in what it's doing, and boy, did the Inspector General of the USPS find some major time flaws. Let me get to that in just a moment. First, welcome to First Amendment Friday. This is my favorite day of the week because it's the day we open up the phone lines and every single subject under the sun is fair game for you. If you want to comment on all of the crazy things that have been going on this week, including reports that we've got three active foreign national assassination teams on American soil, and their aim is President Donald Trump, the candidate for, and I think, odds on favorite to win the presidency in November. And the U.S. government admits it has information about three different assassination teams that are on American soil. And if you say, Lars, your tinfoil hat's on just a little bit too tight, that's a crazy conspiracy theory. No, it's actually what the intelligence agencies of the U.S. federal government, the one that's run by Joe Biden or whoever's calling the shots for Joe Biden, that's who's putting out that information, that we have assassination plots, at least five of them, two of them homegrown, three of them backed by foreign nationals, at least one of them backed by the crazy people running the state of Iran, the biggest sponsor of terrorism on planet Earth. So it's not that far a stretch to suggest they might be involved in that, because Iran wants Kamala Harris as president. She will be as big a gift, if not a bigger gift, than Joe Biden has been to the Mad Mullahs. By the time Donald Trump left office in January of 2021, Iran was down to $4 billion. Today, they've got about $80 billion in the bank, and almost all of it thanks to Joe Biden and not enforcing sanctions on Iran that were sanctioned, that were actually enforced very, very harshly under Donald Trump. So if you imagine a reason for the Mad Mullahs of Tehran to want Kamala Harris and not to want Donald Trump, and would you put it past them to kill him? They are the biggest sponsors of terrorism on planet Earth. So it's entirely plausible. But if you want to join the First Amendment Friday conversation, you're always welcome at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And naysayers, as usual, naysayers always go to the head of the line as long as you're ready to stick around for a couple of questions from me. Our poll on X today, because we, that is my producers and I, put up a brand new question each and every day. I wrote this one because I'd like to know what you honestly think about this. Should the Letter Carriers Union, that's the one that represents people who work at the USPS, which I'm going to be talking about in just a moment, should the Letter Carriers Union be allowed to endorse a presidential candidate when their members are the ones who are delivering many of the ballots in America and picking up many of the ballots in America? I would say no. I don't think the union should be. And if you say, but they have a First Amendment right to do it, not when they have a bias. If you are telling us that the people who will be delivering many of the ballots in America to the voters and then picking up the completed voters and either getting them back to the elections headquarters to be counted or not getting them back, I don't think they should be allowed to endorse a presidential candidate. So you can find the poll question on X at Lars Larson Show. You'll also find it on our website at LarsLarson.com. Now, let me tell you what the Inspector General of USPS found out about how the Postal Service had actually performed its duties. Mail-in ballots accounted for almost half of all the ballots cast in 2020, up 20% from 2016. So for 2024, the numbers will be even bigger and the opportunities for cheating even greater. Guess what? The USPS Inspector General has said that they did an audit, or the Inspector General's office did an audit of the primary elections in 13 different states. And what did they find? They found at least 3% of mail-in ballots got to voters too late for them to vote. So that's 3% of the vote flushed down the drain because they're using vote by mail instead of in-person balloting. And almost 2% of the completed ballots finished by Americans who have a right to vote got back to election officers after the legal deadline. So that's 5% of all the voters in America with their ballots simply flushed down the toilet. The Kansas Secretary of State, Scott Schwab, said he's very concerned. In the August primary just a month ago, 2% of the ballots sent by mail were simply not counted. And his comment was, the Pony Express is more efficient at this point than USPS. And then what do we have? We've been talking this week about the fact that registration lists are full of ineligible, duplicate, fictional, and even dead voters. We talked about North Carolina yesterday, which is just less than 2 months before the election. In fact, just over 1 month from November the 5th, the state of North Carolina is taking 750,000 names off the voter registration rolls. And why? Because they are dead people, because they are duplicate ballots or other flaws. Even a 1 to 2% mail-in error rate because of mishandling or fraud involving the ballots could absolutely swing local elections. It might even have an effect on the presidential election. And all of this is going on, and USPS is saying, we're not sure that we can get those ballots back to you. In fact, the report from the Inspector General shows that in one case involving Nevada, that was a Senate race decided by less than 8,000 votes to determine which party had control of the United States Senate. And what do they find? 95,000 ballots were sent to undeliverable or bad addresses. 8,000 ballots were rejected upon receipt, and 1.2 million ballots never even came back. And the U.S. Election Assistance Commission says that of the almost 91 million mailed ballots sent to voters in all the states 4 years ago, about 70 million of them were returned. What happened to the other 21 million? Nobody really knows. And about $500,000 were rejected by elections officials when they were returned due to voter errors that could have been corrected by elections officials if the voters had actually cast their ballots in person. So do you think that this year's mail-in ballot election, which will have even more mail-in ballots than 2020 did, is going to go well? Because I suspect we've already been warned it is going to be a disaster. It's First Amendment Friday. Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. Naysayers go first at 866-439-5277 on the Lars Larson Show. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
He may talk about serious issues, but even Lars has a sense of humor.
I have a joke for you. The government in this town is excellent and uses your tax dollars efficiently.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
That makes a lot of sense. A lot of nonsense.
Right. You're bloody well right. You know you got a right to say it.
This is the Northwest Nonsense.
How much longer do we have to sit for this nonsense?
That great moment every day where Lars brings you the cold, hard facts without any liberal wokeness from the Daily Dead fish wrapper or mainstream media bias.
The most oft-repeated phrase of the last week in American politics has been, I grew up in a middle-class household. And I bet most of you listening know exactly who's been saying that over and over and over again. The phrase is the excuse used by Kamala Harris every time somebody asks what she plans to do about the crazy cost of gas, groceries, and rent. Now, Kamala Harris doesn't have an answer to that question, even though she's had plenty of time to think about it, but she, quote, grew up in a middle-class home. Now, first of all, can anybody tell me how the economic circumstances of little Kamala 50 years ago has anything to do with the modern-day disaster caused by Bidenomics? I guess the candidate must think that if she creates a fictional childhood of average means, it says, I feel your pain. Kind of the way Monica Lewinsky's boyfriend used to tell us. 5 minutes of fact-checking puts the lie to Kamala's claim of middle-classness. Take her parents, Donald Harris, a Marxist economics professor at Stanford. When Kamala was a kid, his Stanford University paycheck was twice that what the average American earned. Her late mother was a top cancer researcher with a comfortable paycheck. Kamala Harris always tells people that she is a daughter of working class Oakland, California. Well, not quite. She spent her childhood in homes in upscale Berkeley and Palo Alto. If you don't recognize Palo Alto, it is the home of Stanford University and the birthplace of Silicon Valley. She went to a private kindergarten. Now, I couldn't find out what it cost to go to the Berkwood School way back then, but today, if you send your kids to the Berkwood Kindergarten, it costs $29,000 a year. I'm not kidding. For kindergarten, $29,000 a year. The nominee writes about how her family took frequent trips to Jamaica and sometimes went to India now and then. She took private lessons from a famous retired Russian ballerina. I guess some people have a very different definition of middle class. Others, of course, want to invent the kind of background that convinces you to vote for them. The intelligence test is whether or not you're foolish enough to buy it. Now, our questions of the day. I had to include two of them. Number one, Kamala is going to the border today, writes Don Rhodes. All fixed. Garland today assures us he's going after Iranian elections interference and anti-Semitism is bad. Congress is out of town, our president is on the beach, and Israel is ramping up attacks in Lebanon. We are now more at risk than ever before. And don't forget, it's Friday. You're supposed to forget about all of this by Monday. We are doomed, signed Don Rhodes. But the second one came in from Josephine, who wrote, Lars, I have three questions. How much does it cost to run the light rail orange line through Milwaukee? I see it all the time with anywhere from 2 to 5 people on it during the day. Number two, why is TriMet adding floors to the parking structure at Park Avenue, the orange line? During COVID, it was quite full. Since COVID, the lowest level is oftentimes not full at all. And number three, why is Kamala using Air Force Two for her campaign trips? I thought that plane was for official vice presidential business, or am I not seeing correctly? Keep up the good work keeping us informed, signed Josephine. Well, number one, how much does it cost to run light rail? The newest line that they're proposing to build over the Columbia River as the excuse for the interstate bridge, it is going to be just over $1 billion per mile. It's going to cost tens of millions of dollars to operate it, and you're right, it will not be operating full. Average per capita transit ridership is down. Why are they adding more to a parking structure that's not full at all? I think because handing out construction contracts, especially at election time, is probably good for politics. And number three, why is Kamala Harris using Air Force Two? I'm sure that on every one of those trips, she manages to find some part of the trip that she can call part of the official business of being vice president and then justify its use to get her where she wants to campaign. And now today's Daily Grill.
Insane.
Are you completely insane?
Ridiculous.
They get more and more ridiculous.
Flat out dumb.
You're even dumber than I thought.
Who deserves today's Lars Grill of the Day?
Maybe you're just really, really stupid.
Find out right now.
I'm going to give today's Daily Grill to the state of Oregon for offering up offshore leases of wind farm locations in the Pacific Ocean when the whole business has gone terribly wrong and they had plenty of warning. We have brand new windmills on the East Coast, brand new. less than 6 months old, that just simply fly apart for no reason except maybe bad design. And major energy companies have been fleeing from projects that don't pencil out even with billions of dollars of taxpayer subsidy. And all that to massive public opposition to wind farms off the Oregon coast, the southern Oregon coast, and lack of infrastructure to actually get the energy from the coast to where the consumers are. And of course, taxpayers are going to be asked to pay for that. Today's best email, but you can always send more to talk@LarsLarson.com. Andrew writes, and Lars, the Vancouver School District number 37 just sent out a list of political stuff we can't have at work. I work as a custodian. I'm okay with no posters from either party and so on. No shirts, no hats. They say Trump or Harris. Bumper stickers are okay. You can wear a button, but it can't say Republican or Democrat Party. That's BS, all because of the name Trump. What, 30 days until the election? This stuff should have been told to us before school started. It's called one staff member got offended when somebody wore a Trump hat. I will cover the back of my car with Trump stickers. Trump 2024. It's time to clean up and deport. And by the way, Jeff Snells is a terrible superintendent. Signed, Andrew. Glad to be with you on a First Amendment Friday. Always glad to get your calls. Our question today on X, should the letter carriers union be allowed to endorse a presidential candidate when it's the letter carriers who are going to deliver the ballots and then pick up the completed ballots and maybe get them back on time? My answer to that is no. Today's poll on X is brought to you by Ultimate Truck Services. If you rely on trucks for business, Ultimate keeps your biggest assets on the road and running right. Find them at Ultimate Truck Service.com. Let's go first to Mike. Hey, Mike, welcome to First Amendment Friday on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Thank you, sir. First time caller.
Thank you.
Do you think this coming presidential election will be decided by the Supreme Court?
No, I don't. The last time we came close to that was when Al Gore lost to George Bush. He even conceded. And then he decided that maybe he could win it in the courts. And he went all the way to the Supreme Court and wanted the Supreme Court to order Florida to count the ballots in a way that was not specified in state law. In other words, Al Gore wanted the Supreme Court to change the election laws of Florida after the ballots had already been cast. The Supreme Court said no, count it the way that state law requires it. Do you think it's going to go to the Supremes?
It's crazy times right now, and I have no idea.
Well, it is crazy times. Almost anything could happen. And by the way, I want to mention this. It's First Amendment Friday, but this one seems hugely important. Burien, Washington wants to clean up those homeless camps, and they pay for service from the King County Sheriff. And now a federal court has ruled in favor of the city, and the mayor of Burien, that's Kevin Schilling, says the law should be carried out immediately. And guess what? King County and its estimable sheriff, Patricia Cole Tyndall, has said, we will not carry out the camping ban. So now we literally have a city that wants to clean up the problem, and we have police agencies like King County Sheriff that are saying, we're not going to do it, even if you paid for that service. That's absolutely shameful. You're listening to First Amendment Friday.
The Lars Larson Show. What a vegan actually is?
They say cows are bad for the environment because all they do is eat plants and fart, just like vegans.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's First Amendment Friday on the Radio Northwest Network, and it's my pleasure to be with you. If you want to jump into what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's right here at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, that is, you disagree with me, we've had some great naysayers this week. If you disagree, that's fine. For 25 years, we've always said you get to go first ahead of everybody else. Now, one of the questions I think people ought to be asking themselves is, will the voters actually elect state lawmakers that can actually fix the problems of the state, in this case, the state of Oregon, although the same question ought to be asked of the state of Washington. Well, Raymond Love is running for Oregon's State Senate District 25, covering Gresham, Troutdale, Fairview, and the Rockwood area of East Multnomah County, and he joins me now. Mr. Love, welcome to the program.
Good afternoon, Lars. Thanks for having me on the show.
I see that you've got an agenda, and I guess I would say that I support most of it, because you want to improve police, fire, EMS, and all the rest of that. You want to support parents and kids and get better schools. I guess it comes down to the how. This is the question we keep wishing that Kamala Harris could tell us how, you know, you're going to solve things. You're not Kamala Harris, but I'd like to know, how do you plan to go about all this stuff?
So, Lars, I appreciate the question. So a lot of what's going on, and we all can see it every day in our everyday life. I live right near Rockwood, basically in Rockwood, and the cost of living is through the roof. And what we need to do is lower that cost of living. And how do you do that? You implement common sense policies that will get the cost of living down. In the Gresham area, you know, Fred Meyer's closed in Rockwood a while back. Housing, we're not building new housing anymore, basically. And so what we're trying to do in our campaign, and when I'm talking to people on the street, we're wanting to get common sense back in place, and let's build more homes. Let's expand the urban growth boundary and do the things that are going to bring the cost of living down. If you're a family guy, you don't care about politics. You care about raising your family. And so that's what we're going to try to do is get the cost of living in Oregon. We're at 31% higher, Lars, than the rest of the nation for the cost of living. It's outrageous.
I hear you loud and clear, but again, I want to go back to the how, because my audience knows what my suggestions are, and I'd be happy to share them with you. When you say we need to build more housing, how do you get that done? The Democrats that are going to be probably the majority in both houses down in Salem this coming year, their answer is just tax the daylights out of people and take the money and hand it out in the form of cash to developers and other people to build housing. I think there's another way to get it done. But again, I want to know the how. How do you plan to do that? We can all agree crime should be down, schools should be better.
And I've talked to a lot of them. The assistant development charges and other fees and things that, yes, they're local, but the state has a responsibility. In my mind, we're way overtaxed. There's enough money in Salem to take some of the costs of the infrastructure that it takes to do large-scale projects and bring them back to East County so that we can put up larger developments and have the infrastructure paid for partially with taxpayer dollars, rather than if you're a builder right now, you may pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in fees to build a house, and then trying to call that affordable for a guy living in Rockwood is just not realistic. So we can bring those costs down. And then the second piece is in Gresham, particularly a lot of the fees and stuff that go for services through property taxes do not come back to Gresham. If you look at, for example, Hillsboro, Medford, some of the other cities, what happens with their taxes when they go up to the state and come back down is much different than what's happening in East County.
How would you go about making better schools, and what role does the legislature play in making that happen?
So I don't have it all totally figured out, but here's the basic concept. You know, my sister is a vice principal, my best friend is a teacher, and what I've been told, and I know from my own experience in the schools in Gresham, the parents that are involved in a kid's education have a much higher probability of a good outcome. Oregon has really poor, probably like 45th out of 50 states in the outcomes for education. I think we should tie parental involvement to the education funding. If you're engaged and involved with your child, your school or your school district or your child gets more money, and then we give them options. Let them go to charter schools. Let them go to other options besides some of these schools that have failed us. You know, if you're living in Rockwood, why can't you have a nice new house, a nice new school? Why is that limited to Persimmons, for example?
Okay, but not to get your sister fired or anything, but since you brought her up, too many of the schools have a group of employees, and the minority of that number are teachers. And the majority of those folks are not teachers. Now, they're not all janitors. So if that's the case, could we talk about reducing administrative overhead in schools, put more people teaching the kids and fewer people as the support people? Should any school district have 50% teachers on its payroll and the other 50% do something else?
I 1,000% agree with you, Lars. If I could wave a magic wand, I would cut the administrative costs by 40-50%. We live in a blue state. And what I'm trying to do is have common sense solutions that even the teachers unions and everybody can get behind. I don't think this is a political issue. When you talk to a family in Rockwood, they're not talking about politics. They're not talking about any of that. They're thrilled that someone who could soon be in office is actually talking to them about how to make their family and their child's life better. And most of those people are willing to get engaged if they can get results as a result of it. A lot of them, you know, if you tell me, hey, if you go to your parent teacher conference, more money is going to flow to help your child who needs help, I think you're going to get a lot more engagement from the average guy who's just trying to put food on the table.
I'm talking to Raymond Love, who's running for the state Senate in Senate District 25. Tell me this, you've got a real job in the real world, don't you?
I do.
Okay. Are there other people in your profession who are not there anymore because they weren't very good at it?
There are.
Okay. I mean, you know, when somebody's not good at something, they end up not doing it anymore. Do you think the unions are going to buy the idea of saying, when we have mediocre teachers, they need to go?
I think it's an incremental approach, Lars. I feel what you're saying about needing to fire people, but I'm about bringing the people together. And I don't think in this environment, trying to decide who we're going to fire is as helpful as getting the parents engaged. If you just look at the data, when a parent is involved, and I'm not excusing the teachers or justifying not making the changes you're talking about, I'm just an advocate. You know, I started off as a private in the Army. I'm one rank from a general now. And you bring people together.
Well, let me ask you something. If you were no good as a private, did you ever get to private first class and then to corporal and then to sergeant and then up the ranks to general? Would you advance through the military just because you stayed there a long time?
Absolutely not, and I advocate
for what you're talking about. And is it unfair to apply that same standard to teachers? If you're not very good, you need to find the door and a new profession. What's wrong with that?
I think the key, Lars, is not about dividing one side against the other and saying we're right and you're wrong. What I look at is what people do. My opponent actually has advocated for more taxes, more all the bad things that have happened in the last couple of decades he's been a part of. And so I'm tired of, like, putting ourselves in a position where we're arguing about who's left, who's right, whether to cut teachers or not cut teachers. I'm trying to implement policies that will make a difference for the children.
Raymond, real quick, before we run out, where can people of your campaign online?
Absolutely. Thanks, Lars. It's VoteRaymondLove.com, and we're looking for volunteers. And if you want to donate to the campaign from anywhere across the state or the nation, for that matter, please do.
Very good. That's VoteRaymondLove.com. Back in a moment. It's First Amendment Friday. We'll get to your calls. We're on the...
At least someone has a plan for illegal aliens.
Back in the White House, I will terminate every open borders policy of the Biden administration and begin the largest deportation operation in American history.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's First Amendment Friday, live on the Radio Northwest Network. And this segment of the show is brought to you by 540training.com. 540 Training, concealed carry, home invasion defense, and personal defense online at 540training.com. Well, we have a wealth of naysayers today. So naysayer number one is Killian. Killian, what do you and I disagree about that makes you a naysayer?
Yeah, hey, Lars. Thanks for having me. And I have to back up the sheriff that refuses to book the homeless people from the city. I think that they're in the right and that the sheriff has that responsibility.
Well, no, how does the sheriff get to decide if a city like Burien, and that's what you're referring to, because I referred to Burien passed local ordinances that said that they can clean up the homeless camp. So people are camping on public property. They have no right to do that. They're creating a hazard because they're in many cases, using the streets or parks as their toilet, as the place to drop their dirty needles and everything else. So the city of Burien said, we're going to fix that. And we're going to fix it by cleaning these homeless camps out. They have to go all the way to court, and the courts say, you're right, Burien has a right to do that. How is it the sheriff's, how does the sheriff have the latitude to say, yeah, I'm not going to enforce that law?
Well, because first it's the sheriff's jail, and so Burien County said that they...
Is it the sheriff's jail, or is it the citizens and taxpayers' jail?
Well, it's the citizens and taxpayers' jail, but the
So the sheriff doesn't own the jail. It is there for him to serve the public. If one of the cities in his county says, we've passed a law, we're not going to let people camp on public property and create a danger to the people in our city, and occupy property they have no right to occupy, the sheriff gets to say, it's my jail. I decide who gets locked up and what the laws are. Why don't we just turn the legislature over to all the sheriffs and let them write all the rules?
Well, it's not about turning the legislature over. It's about the which legislature the sheriff follows, which isn't the city's decision. And
why not?
The sheriff has to weigh the risk from the people that are in his jail compared
Killian,
to people that are like...
Cities are largely the creation of the state. The state says this is how you can form a city. So the state has the authority. The Constitution allocates certain rights and responsibilities to the federal government and says everything else goes to the states or to the citizens. So a state is established because the Constitution says all those other things go to the states. Then the state says you may form a city, and as a city, you may pass laws. Doesn't that authority transmit right down from the U.S. Constitution to the state and from the state to the city, and the city is now making rules under the U.S. Constitution because that's where the original authority flows from? How does the sheriff say, yeah, I don't have to do anything they tell me to do?
Well, it's not about doing anything. It's about having the discretion to decide what is the most important, and they can have the discretion to decide if they're going to arrest somebody or not. And that's a pretty significant power. And so I think it goes along the same lines like in Central Point or in Jackson County. If the Jackson County Sheriff says the jail is going to be overcrowded with homeless people from Grants Pass, that, you know, murderers and gangbangers from Medford are going to go free. So they're not going to arrest.
Hold on. Do they have to arrest all those people or just have that as the backup? If the police came and told you to move along and you refused, at some point you'd end up in custody. But the police don't take everybody in custody. Oftentimes, Killian, have you ever had a police officer tell you to do something? Sir, move your car or step back, get back. We've got a crime scene going on here. And do you just say, screw you? If you have, you probably ended up maybe in custody for a period of time. But the police don't have to arrest everybody. Oftentimes, people actually obey the law when the police come along with the authority and say, you can't camp here, move along. That doesn't mean all those people go to jail, does it?
No, it shouldn't. I don't think that the solution for homelessness or really anything except violent crime is to put people in jail. And
I've never said that it was the solution. The solution is for people to quit drugs, get a job, pay their bills, and don't camp on somebody else's property. Is that reasonable?
Well, if it was private property, yes. But like in Grants Pass,
how about public property? Public property is not yours. Do you get to use the property? I've been to Central Point. It's a nice little town. Do you get to use the public property as your own private property? Can you go down and park on the front lawn of City Hall and say, it's public property. I can put a tent up here. I can establish a home site here. Do you get to do that in Central Point?
Well, no.
Do you?
I understand the problem.
And if somebody does do that, what should you do with them? What should you do with them if they...
How that person's acting. I think that if they're respectful...
What if they're acting very reasonably? Somebody goes down acting totally reasonably, sets up their household on the front lawn of City Hall in Central Point. I haven't seen the City Hall, so I don't know what it looks like. But say they just say, my family is going to live here indefinitely. If they do that, should the city just say, well, I guess they can do it. It's public property. So one person out of an entire city is using public property for his own use. Isn't that theft?
No, because I don't think that somebody if somebody's sitting in their living room.
So if I come and occupy your home tonight, Killian, if I come to your home tonight and say, hey, Killian, I need some extra space. I'm taking over part of your home. I'm not stealing anything from you.
Well, you didn't pay taxes for my home, so that's where the problem is.
Well, it doesn't matter whether the homeless people aren't paying taxes, are they?
They could be. When I lived in Hawaii, I've worked with plenty of people that were homeless and had jobs, and so I don't think that...
Then why don't they go out and get their own property? Killian, you're working awfully hard to defend the indefensible, but it's a good naysayer call. Thanks for the call. It's First Amendment Friday on the Radio Northwest Network. The Lars...
to First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Happy Friday.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
I'm your lying dog-faced pony soldier.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Crank that speaker. Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to Lars Larson Show. It's a pleasure to be with you on my favorite day of the week, the day we open up all the phone lines and every subject is fair game. And as is always true on this show, naysayers go to the head of the line. Now, here's a question. I'll put it in a way that you may find uncomfortable. And that is, should prisons in America allow any man who simply claims that he is trans, that while born a biological male, he now identifies as a woman, and now he wants to be incarcerated if he's committed the crime and been convicted in a women's prison instead of a men's prison? Prison rape has been a problem, I would imagine, as long as there have been prisons among human society. Except now, the woke folks in America, and I'm not one of them, have decided we're going to make prison rape even more of a problem than it's ever been before by incarcerating biological men with biological women, because the biological men claim that they are women. And one of the people who's pointed out this pernicious problem is Sarah Parshall Perry, who's a legal fellow at the Mies Center for Legal and Judicial Studies at Heritage. Sarah, welcome back to the program.
Thanks for having me back, Lars.
This seems like, I'm glad to have you back. This seems like such a no-brainer that when they first began asking, and a lot of us did, well, if you're going to identify these as women, are you going to put them in the men's prison and have them, you know, pretend to be women? Or are you going to put them in the women's prison, which seems really problematic? And I would have to admit to you, I was stupid enough to think, well, they're never going to do that. Except it is true that American prisons, depending on the state, are doing exactly that, isn't it?
Yeah. Yeah, that's exactly it. Listen, the prompting for the writing of this piece was a Senate hearing, Senate Judiciary Committee subcommittee hearing this week on Wednesday on the anniversary of the Prison Rape Elimination Act, or PREA. George Bush signed it into law over 20 years ago. This is ostensibly a hearing to celebrate its advances and say where its weaknesses were. And what I was very gratified to find out was that there were individuals willing to testify to the fact that while the aims itself might have been good, the actual expression of what's happened in the Prison Rape Elimination Act since the onslaught of gender identitarianism has actually been anything but the elimination of prison rape. And in fact, biological women are being disproportionately sexually held in situations, sexually assaulted situations where they are housed in 6x6 and 8x8 cells with biological men. So it is no wonder to me that these incidents are actually increasing. I'm glad the Senate called sort of hearing on this to celebrate the gains, but now we're hearing more, and I think this has been undersold, how many women are actually being sexually assaulted by biological men. And the numbers of individuals who are requesting now, in addition to being housed with biological women, the taxpayer funding of, quote, gender-affirming surgery is, I think, unconscionable to me, and it's a misuse of government dollars, but we've seen, unfortunately, a Seventh Circuit opinion that's actually determined the failure to provide these services is a violation of the Eighth Amendment's prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. So it's truly upside-down world in federal incarceration.
And by the way, sir, there is one presidential candidate that I'm aware of who's in favor of this and has spoken out loud and long about how we have to provide this sexual surgery to people who are incarcerated. And that's Kamala Harris, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, that's exactly it. And in fact, while she was running for president back in 2019, the Human Rights Campaign called her the most pro-LGBTQ rights candidate in history. She's already talked on record about what she has done as a federal prosecutor in California, trying to get these procedures, these surgeries covered for inmates who are transgender at taxpayer offense. So it's not really any surprise to me that we are seeing exactly the same rhetoric now coming up again. My hope is that voters this year don't have a short-term memory loss problem and can remember exactly what the Human Rights Campaign has called her, how much she has pushed for these procedures, and how she's been unwilling to defend biological women who are in confined spaces, who are sharing these particular private areas with biological men to the detriment of their own physical health and safety.
Well, and Sarah, I guess maybe people have been too squeamish to talk about this, but if you make the assumption that because a man now says he identifies as a woman, that does not mean that that biological man does not still respond to heterosexual urges to have sex with women, even though you see, but he's a woman. So is he a lesbian at that point? Is he still? It doesn't matter what label you put on him. He's still got the inclination to have sex. And in many cases, maybe it's consensual sex behind bars, which in every prison I've ever visited as a reporter, all that stuff was considered completely outside the rules and not allowed, although we all know right. that it does go on inside the prisons. Right. So you're putting these men in there, and even if they call themselves Susie and wear a dress or wear female clothing and makeup and hair and all the rest of that, they still have those urges, and that means that they're going to act on them in some cases, and in some cases, in a criminal fashion, right?
That's exactly it. And we can't see this as anything other than largely opportunistic. Many of the people who are actually incarcerated, these biological men who suddenly present as women, do so after conviction so that they identify as women, gain access to women's prison spaces. And when they are, as in the case of the Bureau of Corrections in the state of Wisconsin alone, 50% of trans-identified males have been violent sexual offenders. You are literally letting the fox into the hen house. And this is a situation that will not get better unless we stand up and we legislate at the federal level. 2,200 inmates now in the state of California alone since Kamala Harris made that statement about the good work she had done providing these treatments. Now the number has skyrocketed because, of course, California has been largely lost to reason for some time under Governor Gavin Newsom. But as prosecutor in California, she made sure that we could open up the individual doors to biological men who felt that maybe for one reason or another, they were going to use this opportunity.
Sarah, is there any, I'm talking to Sarah Parshall Perry from the Mies Center. Is there any chance that their in-house counsel, either the legislature or the Department of Corrections in whatever state, didn't tell them, if you do this, you are creating a hostile situation, number one, that's lawsuits. You're going to create sexual assault, that's more lawsuits. You're going to be writing checks from now until the cows come home if you do this. And are they just ignoring that advice? Or am I wrong about that?
No, that's actually a great point. But because we have this very sort of noxious Seventh Circuit opinion, which has determined the failure to provide housing in these facilities with biological men, the failure to provide gender-affirming care with these biological women at taxpayer offense is a violation of the Eighth Amendment. Until we see another federal court weigh in on this very problematic issue, all of these attorneys, and God bless them, this is yeoman's work right now, are having to essentially find themselves between a rock and a hard place. They want to protect the physical safety of these biological women. We hope so, at least. But they are bound by one very, very bad case from the Seventh Circuit. And what we're seeing now is, I think, sort of a kowtowing on a grand scale to housing these individuals and then determining that these Bureau of Prisons, these corrections, state correctional facilities, are willing to essentially pay the piper if these individuals are suddenly assaulted. In fact, we know of a woman who, for example, complained about a biological male who was spying on her when she was using the bathroom, and she lost her parole.
Unbelievable. Sarah Parshall Perry from the Mies Center at Heritage. Back in a moment. You've got the Lars Larson Show.
With today. My wife.
message from Lars.
I'd like to apologize to anyone I've not offended yet. Please be patient. I'll get to you shortly.
Who's next? This is the Lars Larson Show.
It is wrong to somehow suggest that an undocumented immigrant is a criminal.
Being an undocumented immigrant is not a crime.
I know what a crime looks like. An undocumented immigrant is not a criminal. An undocumented immigrant is not a criminal. An undocumented immigrant is not a criminal.
Now, I could let this audio go on for about another 30 or 40 seconds of Kamala Harris saying that. I just wanted to cement the idea. She didn't say it once or twice or three times. She has said it dozens of times. It is not illegal. And it is not a criminal act to enter the United States. Now, she's a lawyer. She did graduate from law school. She's a former district attorney, former attorney general of the state of California. And yet she insists that crossing into the United States illegally is not a crime. So accidental presidential candidate Kamala Harris is visiting America's border for the very first time in more than 3 years since she was appointed as Joe Biden's border czar. And despite all the best efforts of the mainstream media to say she was never border czar, there is no such position. Why, perish the thought, even though most of the legacy media called her the border czar a little over 3 years ago when Joe Biden basically handed her that whole garbage sack that is border issues and said, you're in charge of this. Well, she's making her very first visit to the U.S.-Mexican border today in the town of Douglas, Arizona. And what do you think she's going to say? We can't actually ask her what her position is because Kamala Harris very rarely sits down for any kind of interview. In fact, Wednesday night was the day she sat down for her very first solo interview, you know, one where she didn't have Tampon Tim, her running mate, with her. And what is she going to say? She's going to tell us that American sovereignty requires settling rules at the, or setting rules at the border and then not enforcing them. Because that's what she said before. She's going to say, we have to have more resources for the Border Patrol agents to do their jobs. Expect her to say that during today's visit to the border. The only problem with that is, what has the Biden-Harris administration been doing with the Border Patrol agents? It has. It's been using them to facilitate the quick transition from one side of the border into the United States, where literally millions of people have been released by the Border Patrol into America. The number is about 7 million that the Border Patrol actually identifies. These are people we had in custody. These are people we released. And a stunning number of them are convicted criminals. Another number of them, about a quarter of a million of them, are actually accused criminals, and they would likely be found guilty. She's going to say, well, we've got to have more machines to detect fentanyl at the border entry points. And she's also going to say, because this is a quote from Kamala Harris, that she rejects the false choice between securing the border and creating an immigration system that is safe, orderly, and humane. Now, about that, I've got to really take issue with Kamala Harris. But first, I want to invite your phone calls. It is First Amendment Friday. It's a pleasure to be with you. And I'm always glad to take your phone calls at 866-HEY-LARS. And if you're a naysayer, we put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. Vote in our poll on X. And the question today, because we put a brand new question up every day, today, should the Letter Carriers Union, that's the one that represents USPS mail carriers, should the Letter Carriers Union be allowed to endorse a presidential candidate? They have. They've endorsed Kamala Harris, when in fact it's USPS and its members of that union who deliver your ballot to your home or not, and they then pick up your completed ballot or not and deliver it on time to the elections headquarters or not. And it turns out that their own inspector general at USPS says that up to 5% of ballots either never got delivered or never got brought back to the elections headquarters in a timely way. So should the Letter Carriers Union be allowed to endorse a presidential candidate? I don't think they should. I don't think they have any right to do that. And taking a partisan position and then saying, by the way, we're the ones who bring you your ballot and we're the ones who either do or don't make sure that your ballot makes it back in time. Yeah, why distrust a system like that? The poll on X can be found at Lars Larson Show and at LarsLarson.com. But let me tell you this about what Kamala Harris had to say. Rejecting the false choice between securing the border and creating an immigration system that's safe, orderly, and humane. Well, consider this. As we're standing here today, more than a million people will come into the United States and emigrate legally to the country. There is a system for doing that. It has been in operation for the last few decades. The number of legally admitted immigrants to America was about 300,000 during the time of Ronald Reagan. It rose to about 600,000 during Bill Clinton in the 1990s. It went to above a million under Barack Hussein Obama. America still ranks as the single most generous country on planet Earth among all the countries you'd actually want to set foot in. I mean, I'm not talking about Sudan or Yemen or, you know, garbage country like that. I'm talking about countries you'd actually want to live in. We are the most generous when it comes to allowing people to come in. And that system is safe and orderly and humane. What Kamala Harris is talking about is decriminalizing, making it legal for people to simply roll into the United States without even asking, no permission given, and immediately they get all the rights and the privileges under the U.S. Constitution. That's what she wants, because that's where the Democrats see the future of voting in this country. Let in millions of illegal aliens, have them automatically signed up to vote, and then vote them like crazy in the election, and expect them to try that in less than 2 months, just over 1 month from now, in the November 5th election. To your calls on a First Amendment Friday, let's go first to Jason. Hey, Jason, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
The future, Lars, the future looks like it's going to be doctor-assisted suicide like they have in Canada, with people for, they make it available for people with mental illness. If we vote Kamala Harris into office, it's going to be available for people with let's say, people that are suffering from homelessness, bankruptcy, drug addiction. Well, they already have fentanyl for people that are suffering from drug addiction to take care of them.
But let's say, kills a lot of people every year, doesn't it?
Deplorables, you know, the basket of deplorables. Geez, if I can get that out right. You know, this is going to be, it's going to be 4 more years of genocide, Joe. If we get her back, if we get her in office,
I agree.
You know, it's really getting out of hand.
You've got to make people understand this, though, Jason, because I agree with you 100%. I mean, this is not probably the number one issue in America for most voters. But if you said to them, do you think you should exterminate members of your family because they're old, because they're incapable, you know, because they're either mentally or physically limited, should you start just simply knocking them off? And once, if Kamala Harris, she will not say whether or not she's still in favor of nationalized health care, but before, she has said before that she's in favor of nationalized health care. So you'll have a government that has the power to legalize doctor-assisted suicide for everything, including mental illness, depression. Just as you said, Canada is doing crazy things with doctor-assisted suicide. And if you say, why would the government want to knock off its citizens? And the answer is, once you make the government 100% responsible for health care for all citizens, well, then all of a sudden they've got a financial incentive. Could we get rid of the ones that are really, really expensive? And that would include people with physical and mental incapacities. And the government will have a dog in the fight when it comes to knocking off its own citizens. And I don't want to live in a country like that. Back in a moment. It's First Amendment Friday at 866-439-5277.
The Lars Larson Show. And now, this musical message to anyone who wants to indoctrinate our school children.
Hey, teacher, leave the kids alone.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program on First Amendment Friday. It's a pleasure to be with you. Now, you know that Israel finds itself under attack from multiple sides. You've got Iran sponsoring the Houthi terrorists who are attacking shipping in the Gulf and in other locations, and somewhat successfully. You've got Hamas, which is waging war from the southern end of the country, and on the northern end near Lebanon, you've got Hezbollah, the terrorist group that is launching attacks into Israel. Again, all three of them backed by Iran. So where is this going to go? well, I'm not the expert, but Adam Weinstein is a retired U.S. Marine who served in Afghanistan, currently the Deputy Middle East Director for the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. Mr. Weinstein, welcome to the program, and thank you for your service in the Marines. Where is this going?
Thanks for having me. Just to be clear, I only did one enlistment, so I don't know if I used the word retired, but I did serve. Where this is going, it's hard to say. You know, it's unclear whether Hassan Nasrallah is dead or not. There was that strike in Dahia, which is in South Beirut, where the Hezbollah headquarters are, and it's unclear whether the leader of Hezbollah is killed or not. If he was killed, that would be a real game changer, because essentially Hezbollah would be completely decapitated, since most of the other leadership is also dead. So I guess we'll have to wait to see what that says. But it's unclear.
Well, just so people know, Adam, this shows that Israel can reach out and decapitate the leadership of one of the terrorist groups that's attacking it. That capability is pretty significant, isn't it?
I think it is significant, and they were also able to kill Hania, the leader of Hamas, the political chief of Hamas, at least, in Tehran, and they've been trying to kill Sinwar in Gaza. And I think to some degree they've restored the kind of prestige they lost after October 7th. October 7th was quite embarrassing for Israel. And so these successes, at least from a tactical perspective, have perhaps restored the prestige they once had.
And but does that mean that Hezbollah simply, that you have to play whack-a-mole, that these terrorist groups just say, well, we'll advance somebody else up the chain and turn them from assistant leader to leader of the group? Or is it that easy? Is it more problematic for these terrorist organizations to get somebody back at the head of their group who can actually lead them in this, you know, this kind of attack on Israel?
Well, at the lower level, it's whack-a-mole for sure. But with someone, you know, at the level of Hassan Nasrallah, no, that's significant. He has a lot of legitimacy. He's arguably the most important leader in Iran's axis of resistance. So that would be legitimate. But what remains unclear is what end state does Israel want? I mean, it can dismantle these groups, but while they're doing it, they're creating a new generation of enemies because of the high civilian death toll that's coming with it.
But is there any other way to achieve it short of that? Because I know that from the left in America, you're hearing protesters say you have to do this without hurting civilians, except the terrorist organizations, as a deliberate strategy, have surrounded themselves with civilians, knowing effectively we can do what we want and you can't shoot back at us because you might hit a child or a non-combatant. And they do that on purpose to protect themselves. Is there any effective strategy against that?
Well, look, there may be some naivete on the left when it comes to how fighting terrorists who purposely want civilian casualties, which is part and parcel of their strategy. But at some point, you have to ask, you know, has Israel made its point? Has it restored whatever deterrence it claims it was trying to restore? Is it going to be on this campaign forever? And I think at some point, Israel has to move towards diplomacy and go back to a defensive posture. If its aim is to kill every single last terrorist in the region who might seek its destruction, well, that's a war that's going to last for decades.
Well, let me ask you about diplomacy, because I'd like to see Ukraine resolved through diplomacy. I don't see Russia having a full-on victory, nor do I see Ukraine having a full-on victory. So the final outcome of this has to be somewhere in between those two markers. But at least you've got players there who might actually stick to what they claim or what they promise. What do you do when you're engaging in diplomacy with terrorist organizations that don't exactly feel obligated to actually abide by what they've agreed to? Unless I'm wrong about that, and there's some terrorist organization out there that actually holds to its agreements.
No, I don't think you're wrong. Look, there's no such thing as a quote permanent ceasefire with a group like Hamas or Hezbollah, because they don't think that way. But on the other hand, you can have a ceasefire and try to build back your defensive posture and have better relations with the people. And try to create conditions that delegitimize Hamas and Hezbollah. Look, one of the reasons Hamas
is able to have a stranglehold over Gaza is because Israel cut off Gaza from the rest of the world. Now, that's not the only reason. Yes, Hamas was voted in. Yes, there are some extreme attitudes among the population of Gaza. That can't be denied. But I think some of the policies that Israel pursued enhanced the legitimacy of Hamas instead of eroding the legitimacy. So again, I'd go back to the point I made earlier. Israel has shown that it can decapitate these organizations. Israel should have restored deterrence by now. At what point is enough enough? Because I don't think it's in anyone's interest for this to go on for years. We're already coming up to the one-year anniversary.
I'm talking to Adam Weinstein, who's I said retired. He's a Marine veteran who served in Afghanistan, now at the Quincy Institute for Responsible Statecraft. And when people lay down that, that indictment of Israel, well, you cut these people off from the rest of the world. I've been to that country 5 times in the last 20 years, and it was pointed out to me that there were times where, both Palestinians from the West Bank and people from Gaza were able to travel out of Gaza, go to community college in the neighborhoods nearby, work at jobs, and that both supplies and products flowed in and out of Gaza. But all of that depended on not having a bunch of terrorists coming out and blowing things up or sneaking out and killing people. And the minute they do that, then the limits slap down. And all of a sudden, a whole bunch of people in Gaza find themselves, I can't go to my job, I can't go to school in Israel proper, I'm stuck here in Gaza, oh, those bad Israelis. Well, hold on. What should Israel do when they are allowing people to flow in and out of Gaza for commerce or supplies or anything else, and then there are terrorist attacks? Is there any other responsible response than to shut down those entry points?
Yeah, they could have shut down the entry points without having a complete blockade. Look, I mean, I think, as you said earlier, a lot of times the answer is somewhere in the middle. Again, the Israeli society was brutalized by the Second Intifada, and when there are buses blowing up, you're inclined to shut down the border. I understand that. I understand that very well. But the point is there a middle path available? And is there a middle path available right now? And I think that's if I was an advisor to Netanyahu from the beginning of this war, I would have said, look, have a more targeted campaign. And the message to the Palestinian people is that, hey, there's an option other than the Hamas option. But I don't think that's been the message that has been sent. If anything, I suspect that Gazans are more radicalized than they were at the beginning of October 7th.
And probably that was the intent of Hamas when they knew what the response was going to be after October 7th, and they knew what Israel's response was going to be, and now they have more support than ever before. So they got what they wanted. Yeah. They slaughtered a lot of people.
And they have more global support. In some sense, Israel walked into that trap. And I understand, look, the Israeli attitude is, hey, the world is going to be against us whether we show restraint or whether we go all in. So we might as well go all in. I know that's the Israeli attitude, and I understand the logic behind it. But I think it is risky for the state of Israel when you have an entire generation of Americans and a global generation that now see it as the bad guy.
And that's a very good point. That's Adam Weinstein, who is retired from the U.S. military.
Ask Lars if he wants to run for public office, like president.
Do you know how much power I'd have to give up to be president?
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. Hey, I got a question for you. If Northwest governments are going to give away tents at taxpayer expense to homeless drug addicts so they can spread them across the landscape and create all kinds of problems, should the government have to put its name on those tents? Portland City Commissioner Renee Gonzalez, who's always refused to come on this show, and I don't know why, is tired of Multnomah County giving away 21,000 free tents. That's about 4 times as many tents as there are actual homeless in the city. Now the county aims to unload 6,000 more tents, and Gonzalez is demanding that Multnomah County put the county government label on all the free tents that they hand out to the homeless so the rest of us can know who's to blame. because they block sidewalks, they block public property, and all the rest. I think Gonzalo's request is a good one. People will see firsthand that their tax dollars are funding free tents to the homeless, is the way Gonzalo's looks at it. This segment of the show is brought to you by NickShivers.com for an instant offer to sell your home immediately. No showings, no hassles, and you pick the closing date. NickShivers.com for details. Let's go to Monica, listening on the Radio Northwest Network. Hey, Monica, what's on your mind today?
Hey, well, I'm proud of myself. I went and updated my voter registration, and I just went ahead and voted as Republican. I don't want to take any chances. Also, tomorrow's my birthday. Yay. That's cool. And I get a Trumpy bear for my birthday, but I guess I'll try to get it before the big election.
Does Kamala have also a stuffy out there or a stuffed animal?
There's an official Trumpy bear, but it's like $85. I was hoping someone get it for me for my birthday.
That was kind of pricey. Okay. Although, I have to point out to you, you'd get a ballot if you're registered to vote. In the general election, your party doesn't matter. You are aware of that, right?
Oh, okay.
It matters in the primary election, not in the general election. Let's go to Zach and Eugene, listening on the Radio Northwest Network and KPNW. Hey, Zach, what's on your mind today?
How you doing, Lars? First time calling into your show, but I've listened over the years. I'm an Army veteran.
Thank you.
In between Eugene and Florida back and forth during the nonsense with COVID in Eugene, we decided to move back. And now I've came back across the country to Eugene. And what I'm seeing in this country is unbelievable. And namely, seeing what's going on in Eugene is just sort of devastating. I think a lot of the sentiments that you're bringing up make a lot of sense. But the immigration problem, I don't want to make it hyper-local, because when it comes to geopolitics, the Israel-Palestine thing, I understand we'll maybe not get along on, but we cannot be funding all of these things with a lack of leadership at the top. And if it's not going to happen in your own backyard, it's not going to happen anywhere.
Okay, I'm not sure what you mean, but if it's not, you've mixed, we've got Israel and Palestine, we've got the homeless, right, we've got immigration. Which one do you have an opinion on? And tell us what it is.
Well, I know, that's kind of scatterbrained. But I mean, like, they all sort of interconnect, because it's sort of like compartmentalized, meaning like they all sort of connect. And I'm sure you're aware of this. But the federal government does not represent state governments. But what I've seen as an individual subjectively, who's lived in Eugene before COVID, moved back to Florida, see how it was ran, and had to come back because of family and veteran services and everything else, it's great. I don't like what's going on here. So I think it's like an illegitimate point to sort of preach to the rest of the world when we got what's going on in our backyard, basically.
Okay, so we should be doing a better job. You got to elect better local leaders. Let's go to Anna. Anna, thanks for listening in Medford on the Radio Northwest Network. What's on your mind?
Well, hello, Lars. Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I was curious. You have a beekeeper friend, and I was listening to you, but you never said his last name.
Todd Myers works at the Washington Policy Center, and his big job is following all the craziness with climate change programs and, you know, programs where the government takes billions of dollars literally out of people's pockets and then wastes the money. But his avocation outside of work is he's a beekeeper. What did you want to know?
Well, I put some beehives on my porch, and then one day bees showed up. So I've left them alone so far, and I'm not really sure what I should do next.
What inspired you to put beehives out on your front porch without knowing what would happen next?
Well, I didn't expect bees to move in.
Oh, well, I guess that's what they do. They look for a place to live. You give them a place to live, they're going to be there. Let's go to Brian. Brian, yeah. You're at the USPS union, or you're a member of the union?
No, I work at FedEx.
Okay.
Yeah, so this is Brian, and I work at FedEx, and I'm an airport guy. I work at FedEx at the airport, PDX, and we're all about the grounds thing. So when we're talking about people on the ground making things work, we do it. I guarantee you we do it. That's okay. The only thing I have to say.
That's all you wanted to say is that FedEx does a good job. Okay. That's interesting. Thanks for the call, I guess. Our poll on X, should the Letter Carriers Union be allowed to endorse a presidential candidate? The letter carriers have endorsed Kamala Harris, when in fact, the letter carriers are the ones who deliver your ballot to your home. And when you've finished your ballot and filled it out, they're the ones in charge of returning it to the elections headquarters. And if they don't do it on time, then your vote doesn't count. Is a union like that in a position to endorse one side or the other? It's First Amendment Friday, and you're listening to the Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.
To First Amendment Friday on the Lars Larson Show.
Happy Friday.
Friday is for everybody.
Today, Lars puts you in the driver's seat. You talk about what you want to talk about.
Government is the problem.
No topic is off limits.
You're a lying dog faced pony soldier.
Call 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-HEY-LARS.
Crank damn speakers. Thank goodness it's Friday. Happy Friday.
This is
First Amendment Friday with Lars Larson.
Welcome back to the Lars Larson Show. On First Amendment Friday, we open up the phone lines and every subject is fair game. And I'm going to get back to your phone calls and emails here in just a moment. If you want to dial in to what we call the best conversation in talk journalism, it's here every day at 866-HEY-LARS. And on First Amendment Fridays, a little more liberal, if you can say it that way, about the kind of topics that we talk about. If you are a naysayer, we'll put you right to the head of the line at 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And join me in welcoming Joe Kent, retired Special Forces Warrant Officer, the Gold Star husband of fallen Senior Navy Chief Shannon Kent, who was murdered by ISIS. He is running to be in Washington's 3rd Congressional District as its representative to replace the rather estimable Marie Perez. Because Marie Perez is, she's a piece of work right now because she appears to be trying to convince voters that she's more of a moderate with a few right-leaning votes that she's taken recently. Joe, welcome back.
Hey, Lars, great to be with you.
Do you think that strategy is working out for Marie Perez when she tries to say, I'm really a left-winger, but hey, I voted the right way on a couple of things, so vote for me and put me back in for 2 more years?
Yeah, you know, she's doing basically what Kamala Harris and the rest of the Democrats are trying to do right now. They're saying, pay no attention to my voting record. Pay no attention to what's taking place in our country with the out-of-control inflation, the wide-open southern border, the assaults on our children in the schools, and go ahead and vote for me, even though I voted for all those policies. So, I mean, they have millions of dollars. They're flooding the airwaves with all kinds of fear-mongering and trying to really recreate themselves and really just do anything but discuss their records because the people are rejecting their records because they're actually being hurt by the policies they've enacted. I don't think it's going to be successful. Perez doesn't like to come and answer questions from people. We had a debate last night. She didn't show up for her because the audience got to ask questions. But that's because she doesn't want to discuss her voting record. So I think people are seeing through all of the Democrat lies.
Well, and in fact, one of the most bizarre things I saw recently was we've had that soundbite we've used so many times. You and I have talked about it, where Marie Perez says, people don't stay up late at night worried about illegal aliens coming into the country. And she didn't call them illegal aliens, but that's what she said. And I say, yeah, they do. And in fact, there's a new report that I'm going to talk about in about one segment about the fact that we now know that of the 7 million who came in, the U.S. government, the Border Patrol is aware that about a little over 10%, about 700,000 of them are either accused criminals or the majority are convicted criminals, and 15,000 of them are murderers. And so if you say, well, yeah, Marie Perez says nobody's worried that our country has knowingly allowed 15,000 convicted killers to come in from foreign countries to our country, I would say she does. You know, we do worry about those kind of things. And she says, well, they took that out of context. I don't even know how you could see that in another context. When she tried to disparage the idea that anybody's worried about this, I think a great many Americans are worried about it.
That's exactly right. And she can talk about the context, and so you misquoted me, whatever, but this is where her voting record doesn't lie at all. If people go to MarieWatch.com, they can see what her voting record actually is. She voted against securing the border. She voted against H.R. 2. So really, she can say whatever she wants. She voted to leave the border open to allow the 13,000 murderers into our country that we know of. That's just what we know of. But also, look, we know that our country's being flooded by fentanyl. Right here in our district, we have had fentanyl deaths skyrocket. We've had babies get their hands on this fentanyl and die. We've had illegal immigrants, like the one that killed Washington State Trooper Gadd. They've come into our country, and they've killed people that are trying to protect our community. So her votes have real consequences, and this is what's hurting people. The same can be said for the inflation. She voted for $4 trillion in new inflationary spending. While we have real needs here in the district, she's driving up the cost of every single good that people have to consume every single day while doing absolutely nothing for the district. She voted to print $86 billion to send overseas when we're begging for table scraps to repair the I-5 crossing. So, I mean, it's just absolutely insane, but I think people are waking up. If folks go to MarieWatch.com, they can see what her full voting record is there. They don't need to hear it from her. They don't need to hear it from me. They can see it directly from the House.gov roll call site.
Well, and in fact, I'd love to have her come on the show, but like you said, she doesn't show up for debates because she doesn't want to answer questions. I'd love to ask her a few solid questions about this, about why are you saying this is not something that people worry about when we're letting convicted killers? And you were right to point out that's the 15,000 convicted murderers that we know Customs and Border Protection allowed into the country just in the last 3.5 years under Joe Biden. We don't know, and there are a lot of other people who, among those illegal aliens, who are convicted of other crimes. But she doesn't want to answer those questions because she'd be asked, why doesn't Kamala Harris appear to have a border strategy? Kamala Harris's current border strategy is to say, give me the Lankford bill again, the one that legalizes up to 5,000 illegal entries per day before it, you know, takes action on it as a crisis. So in other words, we had a very small number of people crossing under Trump. We have a gigantic number crossing under Joe Biden, and Lankford, who's a Rhino Republican, said, well, we have this bill that just simply says we are legalizing up to 5,000 illegal entrants per day. And Kamala Harris says, give me that bill and I'll sign it. And that's her only solution for the border.
You know, that's exactly right, Lars. She doesn't want to have these conversations. She likes to operate on sound bites or go into environments where she knows what the questions are going to be or where constituents, actual people, can ask her questions. She will not do that. That's why she dodged our debate last night. It was a town hall style. They passed around the microphone. The first two questions I asked were about abortion. They came from people who I don't think are Joe Kent voters, but I answered their questions. It's my responsibility to be up there and answer their questions. Marie Perez refuses to do that. When you go to one of her so-called town halls, you have to write down your question on a piece of paper and hand it to one of her staffers. I think that's just inexcusable, especially with the amount of carnage that has been wrought upon our district and our nation. We're just talking about the border. She needs to answer those questions. She's been on the record now for about 2 years, voting in lockstep with Kamala Harris and with Joe Biden. So we've got real important issues to discuss. I hope she shows up to our next debate that's scheduled on October 2nd, but we'll see.
Well, and the ballots go out in the next couple of weeks. Joe, remind my audience where they can help you out and where they can find your website if they're curious about your stances on all the other issues.
Yeah, absolutely. If you want to help out my team, please do go to JoeKentForCongress.com. The only advantage that Marie Perez has right now is money. She's outspending us about 3-1 right now. So anything people can give at JoeKentForCongress.com is greatly appreciated.
Oh, well, I appreciate you coming on. And Joe, you've got my endorsement and you'll have my vote on November the 5th, because I can't imagine voting for a member of Congress who doesn't want to answer questions. I also can't imagine voting for a presidential candidate like Kamala Harris, who only says down for softball interviews the way she did on Wednesday night. And she was asked about the border, and all she said was, well, I would sign that bill that legalizes 5,000 people a day. Doesn't make any sense, but then again, it's the Democrats. What do you expect? Glad to get your calls at 866-HEY-LARS. That's 866-439-5277. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. If you're a naysayer, that is, you disagree with my point of view on something, you're perfectly welcome to call the show. We'll put you first in line. Coming up in a moment, we've got to talk about brand new numbers coming right out of the Border Patrol that talks about the hundreds of thousands of convicted criminals that Joe Biden and Kamala Harris have allowed to cross into the United States of America and do it illegally.
Donald Trump with a warning to Hamas at the Republican Jewish Coalition Conference.
If you spill a drop of American blood, we will spill a gallon of yours.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
When Mexico sends its people, they're not sending their best. They're not sending you. They're not sending you. They're sending people that have lots of problems, and they're bringing those problems with us.
Now, I got to tell you something. That was a statement that Donald Trump made after he took that escalator down in 2015 and announced that he was running for president of the United States. And I got to tell you, most of the mainstream media, they absolutely lost their minds. They said, you can't say that. You can't say that when people come across our border illegally, that they are necessarily criminals or more often criminals than not. Well, actually, you've now got some solid numbers to back it up. And the numbers come from the Biden administration, specifically from Immigration and Customs Enforcement. An illegal alien from Mexico shot and killed a man in the middle of a restaurant after a disagreement over what song was playing. That was the story in the news just today. Now, those crimes don't have to happen. We could keep the illegal aliens where they belong on the other side of the border from coming into the United States. But this brand new report from the Biden-Harris administration, because of the massive inflow of illegal aliens over the last 3.5 years, CBP officially estimates it as of May of this year at more than 10 million. I think the real number is much higher than that. But even if you just go with 10 million in 3.5 years, it's disturbing enough. But today's report from ICE made it even worse. They have now allowed in 425,000 illegal aliens who are also convicted criminals. And you say, well, what kind of crimes, Lars, like parking tickets? No. Of the 7 million illegal aliens that ICE actually took into custody and then released into the United States, 663,000 have criminal histories, according to Joe Biden's Immigration and Customs Enforcement. And what kind of crimes are they guilty of? 13,000 of them are convicted murderers. 16,000 of them are convicted of sexual assault. And almost 2,000 of them are facing current homicide charges right now. And yet, what kind of answer do we get from Kamala Harris? Well, she sat down for an interview on Wednesday night. There wasn't much out of it because she wasn't asked hard questions, nor did the young lady, Stephanie Ruhle, from MSNBC, press her on any of these points. But imagine this. The population of Wyoming is about the same number, about 600,000 or 700,000, as the number of convicted criminals and accused criminals who've been allowed to cross into the United States with the acquiescence of the Joe Biden administration. So what did Harris say about the border? Yeah, this is what she said about it in 2021.
Do you have any plans to visit the border?
We are going to the border. We've been to the border. So this whole thing about the border, we've been to the border. We've been to the border.
You haven't been to the border.
I haven't been to Europe. And I don't understand the point that you're making.
Now, that was in 2021. She was talking to Lester Holt from NBC. Matt, did you hear what she did? We've been to the border. I guess she meant it in the editorial we, where it was collectively. But then when he pressed her and said, you haven't been to the border, she said, well, and I haven't been to Europe either. What's the point you're trying to make? This woman has absolutely no concept of what is going on down there. Now, the guy who broke loose this information is Representative Tony Gonzalez from Texas. And what he asked ICE for was national data for the illegal aliens with criminal charges or criminal convictions. Remember, two different categories, those accused of crimes right now and those who've already been convicted of those crimes. Now, This is all of the ones who were taken into custody by ICE, 7 million of them, and then released into the United States. The total number of convicted criminals among those 7 million, 425,000 convicted criminals, 222,000 who have pending criminal charges. Now, those include 62,000 assault convictions, 14,000 burglary convictions, 56,000 drug convictions, 13,000 convictions for homicide. On top of that, 2,500 have kidnapping convictions, 15,000 have sexual assault convictions, and then you've got another almost 2,000 who are charged with homicide. They haven't been convicted yet, but they would add on to the 13,000 homicide convicts that have already passed into the United States. 42,000 of them have assault charges, and 3,200 have burglary charges. So all of this, and then Kamala Harris is asked, well, what would you do? And she says, well, the bill that was passed by the U.S. Senate, the bipartisan bill, they like to call it, a guy by the name of Lankford, who's in the Senate, who's a rhino Republican in my view, agreed to get together with the Democrats, and they came up with a bill. And what the bill did was it provided some additional money for customs and border protection. That's not necessarily a bad thing. It's also not a good thing, because what they've been doing with the money at CBP so far is simply accelerating the flow of people into the country, processing them into the United States without any kind of hold on them at all. So they're illegally in the country. They have no right to work, but they're given a tremendous amount of American resources like hotel rooms and debit cards and airline and bus tickets and all the rest of that. And they know that hundreds of thousands of them are convicted criminals. And Kamala Harris says, I would have passed, or I would sign, the bipartisan border bill. You know what the bipartisan border bill says? It says, we will agree that any number crossing per day that is below 5,000 is okay. 5,000 people a day. That's almost 2 million illegal aliens coming in per day. It would normalize the idea of that number of people crossing into the United States before the administration of Kamala Harris would have to consider it a crisis of some kind. Let's go to James, who's a naysayer. James, welcome to First Amendment Friday. What's on your mind?
Thanks for taking my call, Lars. I wanted to ask you, if the police union endorsed Donald Trump, then shouldn't we be concerned about police officers harassing Democrats?
No, we shouldn't, because you're bringing up the fact that I take issue that the USPS union, the letter carriers union, has endorsed Kamala Harris. The letter carriers union are employees who deliver the ballots that Americans will vote. They also pick up, in most cases, the completed ballot and deliver it back. They've been identified by their own inspector general as having delivered ballots late, too late to vote, and delivered the completed ballots back to the elections headquarters too late. For that union and its members to take a biased position in favor of one candidate or the other, police do not deliver ballots. The USPS does.
So you feel that the letter carrier is going to do a felony by delaying mail or messing with the mail just simply because they're...
Well, I can give you one example from Utah. In the primary election this year, they decided to take a bunch of Utah ballots and they sent them off to a processing center in Las Vegas. Now, I understand that's their system. Guess what happened? Thousands of ballots that were supposed to get back to the elections headquarters by the deadline didn't make it, because USPS, in its bureaucracy, decided to send all that mail, ballots, off to a Las Vegas processing center, and they didn't make it back in time. So could they do that? Yeah, they could. And I'm not saying all letter carriers would do that, but too many letter carriers, if you have gone out and taken a public position, you want Kamala Harris to win, and you have something to do with the delivery of those ballots, I think you've got a dog in the fight. I think you ought to stay out of that and not take any position at all. Individually, vote for whoever you want, not your union.
The Lars Larson Show.
some solid advice from Senator John Kennedy.
Look, if you hate cops just because they're cops, the next time you get in trouble, call a crackhead.
This is the Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's a pleasure to be with you. I've been looking forward to the debate, the vice presidential debate between J.D. Vance, that's Donald Trump's running mate, and of course, Tim Walz. Tim Walz is an interesting character. Both of them have a military history. J.D. Vance actually deployed to Iraq as a military journalist. Tim Walz quit the military right after he got the only orders he ever got in about three decades to deploy to a war zone. And I thought we'd talk about that with Dr. Paul Lawrence, former Undersecretary for Veterans Affairs under President Trump. Dr. Lawrence, welcome back.
Hey, it's great to be with you, Lars, and thanks for your continued advocacy for veterans.
Well, I'm glad to do that because that's the least we can do for men and women who put on the uniform and go off to defend this country. But, and I don't know if you want to stay away from the political side of this, but I'm curious. Both of these candidates have a military history, a very different nature, I think, in both of them. And Walz, a little bit disappointing because we've labored at telling people about the false claim he made to being a command sergeant major, which he made over and over again. Now, only come to find out, he didn't actually get to that. He got to it temporarily and then retired out. As something lower than that. So what should we make of all this?
Well, you're right. The debate will be a really interesting contrast. First, it's great to see that, you know, service enables success for both of these folks, right? But
yep.
If you look at J.D. Vance, for example, we all know he had a troubled home life. He graduates from high school and decides to join the Marines, serves honorably, uses GI Bill benefits to go to college for free, and then goes to one of the country's top law schools. And the rest is history. In 10 years, he's changed his life. That's what's supposed to happen when you serve. You're right, Tim Walz, honorable service of the National Guard, but the part that I think gets every veteran, me included, is misrepresenting your service. It's all there for people to see, to not represent your service accurately, you've got to wonder. And then as you point out, you know, you're part of a team in the military. To not follow your team, and you're a leader of a team, you're not a tiny member of it, you're the leader of the team, and they're being sent to war, and you decide to opt out, that's really troubling. It makes you think, should he become vice president, what will he do, you know, what will he opt out of when our veterans need him?
See, and that's the thing I wonder, because I have not served in uniform, Dr. Lawrence, and I've always made that clear to my audience. My mom and dad were in. Many members of my family have served. My stepson served in the Marines. But when he came out, in talking to veterans over the years as a reporter, they're very particular. You know, if you were a lieutenant colonel and you refer to somebody as a full colonel, you say, no, I was not. I was a lieutenant colonel. They're very particular about that, even to the point where, sadly, I recall one high-ranking admiral, I believe, who was wearing a campaign ribbon that he was entitled to, but it had V for Valor device on it that he was not entitled to. And when that was outed, he went home and blew his brains out. Now, that's not what I'd suggest for anybody, but it shows how seriously people take even small misrepresentations about who you are and what you did for your country.
Oh, absolutely. And I think what happens was now, you know, people realize Walz is not such a great asset to this ticket, because now we wonder about, you know, truths and the like. And I will tell you, when he was in Congress, one of the votes he got to participate in was President Trump's initiative to expand community care for veterans, the right to
yep.
go into the community. He voted against that. So the one point we can think of, say, hey, when you're supporting veterans, you voted against this legislation that they all wanted to, you know, provide community care. So that's another example of, gee, are you on the team or not?
Well, and I kind of wonder, because I've heard from so many veterans that they were frustrated with the VA, which is a civilian-run organization, you know, not a military-run organization, or they'd say, why do I have to travel all this distance or go to some special place? I can get that care right here. And that's what President Trump wanted to do. He said, if the VA is overwhelmed, if they can't provide the service you need as a veteran, you should be able to get the service as close to home as possible. And it's the same medical care. It's just provided by different people. And it was as though the VA wanted to hang on to those veterans and say, no, you have to get it from us, even if it makes you wait longer or not get the care at all.
Right, and this administration has been very reluctant to implement community care, and of course, Vice President Harris has watched over this. So again, we see, you know, then Congressman Walz voting against it, now Vice President Harris not doing anything to ensure that law is implemented. Again, it's pretty clear when you contrast what they do for veterans versus, you know, the aggressive posture President Trump had in his first term for veterans, you see a real difference, and I hope that comes out in the debate.
Well, and the fact that Kamala Harris claims, and she said this over and over, she was the last person in the room when the decision was made for the, now we know, disastrous pullout from Afghanistan. And since then, we've heard his generals told him, this is not going to work out well. You shouldn't do it this way. He got all this advice and said, nope, we're going to do it this way. And 13 service members died. A couple of dozen were badly wounded. Hundreds of people died at Kabul Airport at Abbey Gate when that terrorist bomb went off, and none of that had to happen. They'd gone, I think, 18 months at the tail end of the Trump administration in Afghanistan with not only no deaths but no casualties for 18 months. It was a stable situation, and pulling out in the middle of the summertime when the you know, the Taliban had the advantage and quickly took the country back over, and then leaving, you know, several billion dollars worth of high-tech armament in the hands of a terrorist organization, it all worked out badly, and yet Kamala Harris said she was right there and she was involved in the decision.
It was an epic failure by any measure, an embarrassment, a strategic disaster, which you can't help but think affects, you know, all the things that's happened since then. But you know, Lars, even just personally, I mean, she has never said the names of those 13 folks publicly. Can you imagine on the Gold Star families how hurt they are and what's going on? So it's not only just a judgment problem strategically, but also kind of personally too. So yeah, it's really not a good look.
Well, and do you recall that she was the one who decided, because this was one of those, I guess, elective things to say. She said, I'm the first person, you know, in the last 10 years or in the last 100 years to be in office. And Joe Biden has said the same, and have no service members serving in harm's way. And right after that, the social media exploded with all these service members who were serving in dangerous places under fire saying, hey, what the heck are we? We're right here in harm's way. Did you forget about us? And did Joe say, no deaths on my watch? And Kamala Harris has said the same. And they forgot about the deaths in Jordan, the deaths in at Kabul, and other deaths that have happened on his watch. And he apparently just forgot about all those people.
Well, and I think that's really important to emphasize, right? You forgot about the military. Forget the lie. You just didn't even care enough to understand that you're the commander-in-chief, or you want to be the commander-in-chief, and you're paying so little attention to our military that you would misstate something like that that everybody knows isn't true. So it's really kind of makes you wonder. It's like, wow, when they're in charge, how are veterans in our military really going to suffer?
Well, and by the way, one of the stories, and I only saw it in a few of the major media like the New York Post, but after the one debate she had with Donald Trump and she made some of those statements, the Post came out and said the Gold Star families are very upset about what happened because they did lose people and they don't appreciate being just kicked to the curb by somebody who then says she wants to be the commander in chief. And there hasn't been a word that I can see from the Harris campaign in trying to explain or spin that one.
No, absolutely. And of course, then you know they were invited to the Arlington Cemetery to be with the Gold Star families, and they didn't go. So it's just really it's really shameful.
It absolutely is. Dr. Lawrence, thanks very much.
Thank you.
Dr. Paul Lawrence is the former Undersecretary for Veterans Affairs, serving under President Donald Trump. I may get a naysayer or two on that, but I think both Kamala Harris and Tim Walz have been very much deserving, not just veterans, but active duty military, by making these claims that no deaths happened under their watch, that nobody was put in harm's way and nobody is serving in harm's way. I think that all of that is dead wrong, except the only way you can find out what she actually says about it is if you got a chance to ask Kamala Harris a question, and she's been dodging questions left and right. It's First Amendment Friday. It's a pleasure to be with you. 866-HEY-LARS. Send your emails to talk@LarsLarson.com. And you're listening to the Radio Northwest Network.
upcoming American elections promise some provocative politics, but be forewarned, the Green Agenda may lead to some extreme rhetoric.
Die, gas pumper!
So prepare yourself by listening to The Lars Larson Show.
Welcome back to the program. It's First Amendment Friday, and this segment of the show always brought to you by Oregon Medical Centers, the regenerative medical specialists at Oregon Medical Centers. Now, we always put naysayers to the head of the line, and one of the most notorious naysayers, for the last couple of decades, has been Theodore. So, Theodore, what do you and I disagree about? Let's get right to it without all your personalizations and ad hominem attacks. What do you say?
Well, it's not real. I am always a naysayer, and I will talk about this naysaying topic once you read at least two chapters of a certain book.
No.
Because the guy that called up that's running for whatever in Gresham,
he's running for state senate,
is not going to work.
Why?
And here's the book.
Why? No, I don't want to hear about the book. I want to hear what we disagree. Now, just so we're fair, Raymond Love is the guy who's running for the state senate, District 25.
It's not going to solve any damn problem.
Telling my audience to read a book, we're not going to do that. If you want to summarize what's said,
I'm telling you to read the first two chapters. The book is a $3,100 book, but you can get it for $23.
Well, you come from a rich family and went to a rich private school.
That is Theodore, not why I called.
Okay, then get to the reason you called. You're irritated.
The reason I called is that it's very unlikely that we're going to get a straight vote in Oregon, California, or any of these states. Here's 2 points. When Oregon went to vote by mail, I lived in West Slope.
Don't give us a lot of background. Tell us, get to the point.
After they went to vote by mail, I never got a ballot. Point number two, I voted for Schwarzenegger in California in 2005-06, whenever that was.
And
my grandmother and I did, and we were sharing the same address at the time. They have been voting. They've been dead for 17 to 25 years, my grandparents.
Yeah.
And I haven't lived in California.
But you and I agree on all this, Theodore. Vote by mail is a disaster. The Presidential Commission, headed by Jimmy Carter, said it was the biggest opportunity for fraud. It has turned out to be that way. Now we've got the Postal Service saying we can't get the ballots delivered on time. We can't get them picked up on time. Their own Inspector General says that they've made mistakes at the Postal Service that have affected things. And frankly, Oregon hasn't elected a major Republican since vote by mail went into effect. And I think there's a reason. It allows for cheating. You and I agree on that.
Well, so here's the deal. I then called McClintock in Congress, Lars. He doesn't care. He's a so-called Republican.
Hold on. Theodore, if you want to talk to him about state voting laws, state voting laws are not controlled by the Congress. You should read a civics book one of these days. Let's go to Wynn. Wynn, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hi. I have been going to the Battleground City Council and the Clark County Health Board, and I have been in Vancouver Council also talking about the fluoride. And the fluorideactionnetwork.org, that group has a lawsuit that was going on in San Francisco, and the judge was delayed giving the findings, and it just came out on the 25th.
Okay.
And they said that the EPA needs to take action because it does oppose a potential risk for lowering people's IQs, especially of children.
Understood.
And it causes Alzheimer's and all kinds of other bad stuff. And I was at the city council in Battleground on August 5th. You can listen to the Battleground
Okay,
city
but hold
council
on, hold on. When?
Yeah.
You're in Clark County, Washington, right?
Yeah.
Clark County, Washington does not fluoridate its water. What do you want them to do differently?
No, my property taxes pay for the Battleground schools.
Oh,
that's why I go to the Battleground.
What does that have to do with fluoride, then?
Because the water's fluoridated, and if water's fluoridated, it lowers their IQs, and then the schools end up putting these kids on Ritalin because they get more money if they have problems. And
well, I actually agree with you on that.
I wanted to have water filters. I wanted water filters on the schools and water pipes because fluoride actually leaches lead from the pipes, and a lot of their schools are old.
Except that Clark Clark Public Utilities does not fluoridate its water.
The water in Battleground is fluoridated. That is a fact.
Locally in Battleground, so they could choose to change that, and it's not a bad idea. And I appreciate the call. Let's go to Jeff. Hey, Jeff, welcome to the program. What's on your mind?
Hey, Lars. I was just thinking, you know, Measure 110 has really become a joint venture between the state of Oregon and the cartels, because it's going to produce more jobs than it's ever going to produce recovered addicts, right?
And I think so.
They sued Purdue Pharma for OxyContin, and then they legalized heroin, meth, and fentanyl. How is that possible? Why doesn't anyone say that? I mean, we've opened the state to the cartels. They're the only source of meth, fentanyl, and heroin in the country. And so by legalizing it, we are now in business, and they've created all these jobs with our taxpayer dollars. And they're basically buying heroin and fentanyl from the cartels, feeding it to the people, and then profiting from the treatment.
And by the way, just the other day, what'd they pull off? Was it 5 million or 500,000 fentanyl pills seized in one seizure alone? You're right. And they've used it as a justification to spend literally hundreds of millions of dollars in just a place like Multnomah County, Oregon. Jeff, thanks so much. It's First Amendment Friday, and you're listening to The Lars Larson Show.
The Lars Larson Show.